This is the same man 10 years ago, and you can see the amount of progression he's had. And this knee pad is to catch him when he falls, but he preferred the flexibility. He gradually had more problems. He now has had a knee cage on the other side. To look at some of the mechanics, we can go to the effects of ligaments and acute trauma. And here's a typical normal ligament. And the important thing to appreciate about this posterior ligament is that the fibers are not all perfectly parallel, and therefore these fibers would get tension before those, and that allows for sort of serial fracture when one has strain beyond what the tissues will take, and that's what allows things to lengthen in situ. And here's an example of a ligament that's experienced failure in continuity, and you can see that the fibers are much more disarranged and there are fewer crossing the same track. And that's very probably what's happening in the polio who gradually progresses like the man I just showed you. As far as the question of which ones get in trouble and which ones don't, this is taken off a video. And actually, this is a woman from Alabama. This knee is painful and it's giving her trouble, and it's why she came to see me. And this knee is not giving her trouble. And the difference is the presence of both the better calf and hamstring activity. So she has protective muscles on this side and has about a 15 degree deformity and with full weight bearing at about 25 on that side. If you just look at the pure mechanics of the leverage against the knee, the more they extend, you just keep doubling the amount of leverage against the knee. And so it starts out about 17%, goes up to 34, and at a 30 degree position, it's about 50% of body weight strain on those ligaments. The answer then is a brace to reduce that demand to a tolerable level. These people still have to have a hyperextension in order to lock their knee. And ideally you'd like to keep this about 10 degrees. Most people force you to put it closer to 20 degrees so they feel stable. That 10 degrees is too close to zero, I think, for the chances. And then, of course, the second objective is to allow them free motion to flex their knees. Now, if we look closely, this orthosis is not made at Rancho. It's made out where this man lives. And if you notice, this joint has a hyperextending angle, but this one does not, and it's not as good a joint. What you'd like to have is a joint that's built into hyperextension so that the brace will lock before the limb is locked, and that's where you take the stress off the person's knee joint. The original large hyperextending knee joint is not available anymore because the knee disappeared. But fortunately, this one is being maintained in order just to keep the bulk of the joint away so it doesn't wear people's clothes out, and so we can use it now for a clinical tool instead of a cosmetic tool or clothing tool. Now, another answer is a type brace like this, and a person has a less deformity, why then plastics are appropriate. Unfortunately, the junction between the plastics and the metal uprights is not as good as transverse metal bands provide. And once in a while, one can get away with a knee cage. The best ones are, in fact, the only ones really work are when they have a slender leg and have sufficient narrowness that one can get a condylar contour to hold it up so it doesn't slide down the leg. And that's it's a select group of women that fit, and the thinner men, of course, also will fit that contour. The surgical answer is a triple tenodesis. The operation designed for children like this is a Chinese child. As you know, and it's our custom, at least during the growing years of children, to put them in protective bracing if they start deformities and keep them under control. And Dr. Hodgson from Hong Kong said, "What do you do about it?" And I told him that was my answer. He said, "I mean, what do you do about 70 degrees?" And I said, "Well, haven't seen them." Actually, I had a couple from polio from Mexico. So we decided to better figure out an answer, and realized that we had knee flexion contractures you could never stretch out, and if we could get enough connective tissue back there, it might work surgically. And that was the design. What we did was take semitendinosus and gracilis and make a middle ligament, and then take the iliotibial band and the biceps femoris and join them with the semimembranosus and the gastric nemius tendons and make a triple tenodesis around there, and then protect them with a brace. And here's the first ligament. And the problem you have with this procedure is that you have to allow time for connective tissue not only to heal initially, but then to mature, and that takes, somewhere between 6 months and a year, and so we put them in protective bracing. One potential which has not been tried but might work out would be the new artificial ligaments, which would give us some internal splinting and reduce the amount of protection, or at least the length of protection, and this is something we'll have to try. Here's two examples. Actually, these two patients are from Dr. Gall in North Carolina. We had a correspondence about it, and then he had the patients. Most of my clinical experience right now is advising on a consultative basis for elsewhere, and so this is elsewhere in North Carolina. This is the patient's pre-op problem, and her post-op result. Now, she has stretched out about two-thirds of what she had. She's comfortable, and she's learned to control it. The problems were that the idea of that long bracing was distasteful both to the surgeon and to the patient, and it wasn't done. And so, plus the fact this woman has a weak calf, and she needed some hyperextension to stabilize her tibia as well. And the next patient, and this is not upside down, this was taken at surgery. I guess I could have put it right side up. If you look at it closely, you can see the feet aren't standing. And well, she shows you roughly the idea of hyperextension she had. And she has a good result. In this case, the bracing was followed more carefully because the first result wasn't that good. And so we sort of have a clinical confirmation or an accidental control study that if you don't protect the connective tissues until they're matured, then the surgeries are a waste of time. And that's why the previous examples of or trials of using just a reefing of the posterior capsule, which would be inadequate material in the first place and then inadequate protection in the second place. And this woman, this is a 5-year post-op result, which Dr. Gall got for me just for this meeting. And this woman came about 200 miles to get those pictures, so we're thankful to North Carolina for today. The other problem we have very commonly is a valgus knee. This is initiated by the weak hip abductors and the person going over into Trendelenburg with every step. And of course, we have an unstable foot in this particular patient. If it's mild like that, then an orthosis with a medial support is nice. We found that the large tibial flare is better than just the little cuffs we used to use because you can get a larger area of support. However, if you have a marked knee like this, which breaks out of every orthosis you have, then it takes massive reinforcement of the uprights, and this has worked very well in that man since that time. Equinus is our next, lordosis, the man has both, is our next problem, and that's been the second most frequent cause of back pain, and back pain's been the second most frequent problem. It would appear that the problem is weight bearing, which has transferred the weight from the vertebral bodies where they're designed to support to the facets, and these of course are sagittally oriented, and you're really just hanging on capsule and getting compression of joints that are not designed for that, and local pain is the problem. Here's another video of the same woman, and you can see she has two problems. One is the lordosis to support her not only weak extensors but supporting her unstable limb, and then a Trendelenburg at the same time. Now, one way of helping the back pains with corsets, but one of the limitations of corsets is not to interfere with the amount of pelvic motion the person needs for walking, and so we end up somewhat caught between two dilemmas, and very often crutches and have to be substituted instead, and this may be the factor that will put them into a chair in time. And note the arm strings, we like the Hope corset still too. I still think it's the best support for a trunk. The camp corsets are nice and pretty, but they don't have any stability, and so that still works. Among the deformities, the fixed deformities, the equinus is the most common one we're seeing. And we have two problems. One, the gross one like that, which would put the tibia backwards. The other is this patient came in with apparent varus, but we also see valgus. But the real cause is equinus. And in order to get the foot neutral, one has to put the orthosis in equinus, which means one has to have a heel lift, or, of course, ideally one would do a surgical release. And I'm finding that most of the adult patients are a little reluctant to have surgery, and so we end up with orthotic trials. Then they find they're sufficiently inconvenient that they have surgery after a while. And that's sort of the stage that we're going through with our deformities. Something like this You see the amount of deformity, and if you look at the actual laxity that's going on, you can see that the medial ankle has been stretched out, and there's a lot of arthritic change here. Fortunately, this particular foot is still doing well in a custom molded shoe, which unfortunately I don't have a slide of, and it's a good thing, because otherwise one would have to make this a very rigid foot, which would be very difficult to get the exact position for both mid-tarsal or ankle control. Now, as far as muscle activity, I think it's very important to look at what the manual muscle grade tells us. Beasley in 1945 measured, in that era anyhow, measured about 2,000 patients and about 1,000, I think it's 750, normal children around age 12, and related the manual muscle tests in that group. And there are two critical findings for us. One is that the manual muscle test is only 75% of true normal. And so when we say normal, not meaning normal, we've accidentally confirmed this in studying patellectomies on otherwise intact people and found that big, husky, orthopedic fellows graded these quadriceps normal, and on Cybex test they were 60% of the other side. And so your quadriceps is a very large muscle, and it exceeds even the husky male effort. And so that you have to appreciate that normal is not normal, and we've already had it brought out to us by several of our very basic scientists that there are problems in the so-called normal person. And so when a person says they've come back up to normal, they're probably somewhere in this group or less if they've had polio in those muscles. And that says there's residual muscles to get residual penalties that they're going to suffer later. The other very important point is a grade good or grade 4. This is not 4/5. This is really 40%, which is obviously a major loss. And the trap to that is a person with grade 4 or 5 musculature can perform in a normal manner, and they look normal. And you, every day, therapists and physicians and whoever alike talk about the good to normal patient as if it was essentially the same thing, because 4 and 5 aren't very far apart. Or the word good sounds great, but it's not so hot. And so this is a trap to us. On the other hand, the people with grades 3 and 2 fares 15%. These people have enough disability that they have to substitute, and that's why we have this dividing line of the good to normal, which can look normal, and the fair to poor, which have substitutive mechanisms. Sherrod confirmed that the good to normal in the sense that he did an anterior horn cell count of the muscles, of the anterior horns of the various muscles in the lower extremity, and confirmed that there was no clinical test of weakness in the records unless more than half the anterior horn cells were gone. And so we have a fairly accurate confirmation that good is only 40 or 45% of normal, and therefore we must recognize that these people are working with less, far less than we think. If we relate that to normal quadriceps function, the normal person by quantitative EMG functioned about 15% of normal. And this is consistent with the findings that for unlimited endurance, one needs to function to be low about 20 or 25%. If you take a person of grade 4 or good, doing the same task with the same body weight, that person would be functioning 2.5 times as hard, or 37%, let's say, on a theoretical basis. And so with every step, this person is working that much harder than your true normal. And your grade 3 would be working 100%, and that's, of course, why they substitute. It's already been brought out, you can't do 100% effort for a very long time. And we look at some of the penalties we're seeing of progressive weakness. This is a man who's done very well with a free knee and a minimum strap, but he now cannot keep his knee locked because his hip extensors have lost that final little ump, and so what we've done is just add an anterior strap to hold him in. And that's about his knee. This woman shows a very mild problem, but it's very significant. But her problem is that she's standing in persistent knee flexion, not because of a contracture, but because of a weak calf musculature, which is probably the most unrecognized disability. It's practically become my specialty because people can see everything else, but they send me those still. And the problem is that the normal person who has a knee flexion, which I showed you earlier, and then goes into extension, has just a brief period of quadriceps activity and this should say 15%. Someday I'll change the slide. The person with a weak calf will stay flexed, and that means that intensity then has to go on for three times as long, and so we have an endurance challenge for weak muscles, and these people are wearing out. The answer is a dorsiflexion stop orthosis. This happened to be metal and plastic, but it could be a solid plastic orthosis. The advantage of the double channel, particularly in a polio patient, is that one can have a dorsiflexion stop anteriorly, a dorsiflexion assist posteriorly, and free plantar flexion for easy loading. And so you have much more versatility with a metal joint. And the only ones that can take the solid ankle joint enough to give them the dorsiflexion stop they need is somebody with an adequate quadriceps, because you will get a little more demand on that regard. The other problem one has with the free ankle, and this is a typical standard polio orthosis that we've all prescribed from year one, is a free ankle joint, which gave them a nice long step, is they have no stability and then have to stand on crutches. And one way I've been able to relieve their demands is to give them a dorsiflexion stop. So you notice this is stopped and not going as far forward. She has 5 degrees of dorsiflexion, and that gives her stability. And this particular person happened to get off crutches by doing that. Others have relieved their load, so they're just using their crutches for balance rather than actually weight-bearing. The other answer, of course, the surgical answer, is an ankle fusion. Now, traditionally in the polio experience, we were all doing pan tailors, it seemed like, or we do Lambert-Nudis and do the sub-tailor and somehow had an aversion to stopping the ankle. That was wrong. This is far better. Actually, the Egyptians know this now. They have the most extensive experience with polio now, because they still have their true infantile paralysis. And what it amounts to, if you do an ankle fusion and leave the subtalar joint free, you have 20 degrees of plantar flexion for loading response, and then you have about 5 degrees of dorsiflexion for heel off terminal stance, and you have nice motion. And if you have a deformed foot, the answer is do osteotomies rather than triples, and immobilize the ankle and not the subtalar joint. That's exactly opposite what was done in the 50s and 60s, and we're a little slow in learning. Here's a young lady who has come from Arizona who had excruciating neck pain. She'd had polio just about 30 years ago. She just barely made our 30-year rule. Was having pain, has had all sorts of exercise. Was on TENS stimulation the time she came to see me. The answer was, and if you look at her muscle test, she looks quite good here, but if you look closely, you'll see she's using her suboccipital muscles, just raising her head, is not arching the lower part of her neck, and has cervical weakness. And in her flexion, you can see she's just barely supporting her head. And so she's having chronic overuse of inadequate muscles. And therefore, I prescribed a brace just to here. And the weight of the brace, well, the brace itself gave her many hours of relief a day. But she could only stand it 5 or 6 hours because of the weight on her shoulders, and therefore we went down to this pelvic base, and at that time she decided it was time to accept a fusion, which she just had last week. So I have no follow-up on that, but that's so that we did lots of cervical fusions in the 60s, went through about 30 of them, and by that time the pool of isolated neck problems like that was gone as polio went, and now this group is starting to come back again as the late signs. In wheelchairs, this woman has just a small arc, has weak arms. This has been my one success, not this particular patient. She's just an example of a slide. But we had, it's a nice demonstration of overuse and recovery. A woman who was a wheelchair-dependent person with considerable arm weakness came to Rancho for a period of time while her husband was on a sabbatical. The environment she had to work in at Rancho, it's a quarter mile from my lab to the other side of the highway, and her husband's working in my lab, and so she had a quarter mile to roll just to get from any place. And her arms promptly gave out. We put her in an electric wheelchair, and her arms came back. So by catching it quickly, and I think this will be one of the problems we need is to get the word out that people are starting to have weakness, to be seen early before it becomes irreversible. And by putting her in an electric wheelchair, she recovered her arm strength because we did catch it quickly. She also has stayed in an electric wheelchair at home because now she can go through the entire supermarket rather than just one aisle a day. So she really was being penalized before and hadn't known what she was giving up. So, actually, none of these problems are new. I can show you teenagers or 12-year-olds that recent polios, that for which all these operations and all these devices were designed. They were just unexpected because we didn't anticipate that people would wear out. And I think if we go back to the to Beasley's quantitation of the muscle test, we have excellent reasons why many of these people are wearing out. The big problem is that the polio patient has such a tremendous capacity to substitute. They have normal sensation, and they have normal control of what muscles they have left, and they can do more with the least muscles that any other disability can do. And this has actually raised them to expectations that are now sort of backfiring. And so we've had excessive demands on the muscles and joints, and basically I think the biggest problem is just mechanical strain on the tissues over a long period of time, and tissues wear out. Thank you.
Any questions?
I have.
Yes. Oh, I see.
You're coming over to me.
Johnson from Columbus. Dr. Perry, in our experience, that genovalgus we see in the polio is often related to a very tight iliotibial band, and you didn't mention that, which, have you looked at that? Or?
Well, I've more often seen hip flexion deformities from that.
Yeah, hip flexion, hip abduction.
I'm very reluctant to release an iliotibial band over the knee, because I've found people lose their ability to walk. It's a nice extension of the knee.
Uh-huh. We just had the opportunity to see a young Turkish boy who got polio in Turkey, and his father was a physician over here, whose tibia was actually dislocated by the tight tibial band. I had another question, and that is, the worst genu-recurvatums that we have seen have not been in the flail leg, but within the retained, a functioning quadriceps and an absent hamstring. Would you agree with that?
Well, it's certainly logical. I'm not sure I've seen that, but it makes good sense. And you certainly see it in the spastic patient. Uh-huh. And then also, of course, I didn't mention the equinus, the ankle, which is was true and active, but it was present at over half of our recurvatum, which is another aggravating factor.
One other thing, I wondered in the individual who has a weak calf, and you're going to fit him. It would seem to me that you could fit them with a solid AFO if you used a satch heel to
accommodate. Yes, the very fragile person who just barely has enough quad, that isn't still quite enough, but you're right. Okay. Undercutting the heel or cushion heel will reduce the lever of the solid ankle. And we do those things, but there's still a small group that's still too much demanding on the borderline quadriceps.
And my last point is a kinesiologic one in which I'm not sure whether I understood you correctly, but when you started off, you said that, and I agree that the hamstring and the gastroc are very important in the knee, but you said that with those alone, you could stand with the knee flexed, and I don't think that's true. You would have to have a maximus or you would fall.
Not really. You can do it. You don't have to have a maximus, because the hamstrings are primarily hip muscles. They just happen to... They're two joints, obviously, but they're used in stance as hip decelerators, and the semimembranosus turns off down to 5% or intensity on a quantitative basis, or 10% during loading response. The bicep stays active.
But I don't want to be argumentative, but it's still the hamstrings are knee flexor. With the foot fixed, though, the maximus is the hip extensor, so it would prevent you from buckling at the knee.
If the person has a weak gluteus maximus, they'll use their hams. If they have just a maximus, that's lovely, except they'll get the hyperextended knee, which may not be so lovely. But if a person has a weak gluteus maximus and uses mostly the hamstrings, then they will also get a flexed knee, but they can compromise by leaning forward, and they can do that. The problem is you will have about 10-degree knee flexion deformity if you have just hamstrings substituting, giving you your hip stability.
I just meant theoretically.
Oh, well, I can tell you, but it's both theory and practice works. with just the hamstring, because they really are, they really have a better lever at the hip. They have a lever of average about 7 centimeters at the hip and about 2.5 to 3 at the knee, so they're really mechanically better at the hip.
My name is Richard Owen, and I'm from Minneapolis. I was pleased to find out why knees bend like mine does when I stand without a gastroc, because I had always thought that that had to do with poor intrinsic function in my foot, but I tend to agree with you. The other question I had, have you had or is anybody starting to work on the use of the carbon ligaments in your center?
Ligaments?
Yes, you were talking about the carbon.
Well, they're using it in the sports area, Gore-Tex and things like that.
I know, that's what I was wondering. Is there any plan in your center to work on that?
Well, I think we're going to follow this great idea I just had about 2 weeks ago of trying one of the paralytic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
I had referred one of my patients to the orthopedist in Minneapolis who's working with it, and both of them were awfully cautious, and I'm glad that they are, but it'd be interesting.
Well, I think Ehrman's approaching the, when we're looking to the sports world to test them, but actually, even though the athletes create a more violent demand momentarily, well, I think their experience can apply very much to the paralytic, because you have a long-term strain, and what you don't get instantaneously, you get over time. And so I think that, the initial results with the Gore-Tex ligament is doing very well. And so I think we're encouraged.
The other question I had, you said that 2/3 of your patients had pain, and then you said 50% of those pain problems were related to knees. What of the 2/3 that had pain were related to musculoskeletal, explainable, biomechanical factors?
I'm not sure I understand your musculoskeletal explainable factors.
Well, you explain the pain in the knee on a biomechanical factor, and what I'm wondering is what percentage of the pain people that represented 2/3 of the people that reported had explainable biomechanical causes for their pain?
Well, I'm still not sure quite what you mean, explainable. The Rieker-Vada we can explain on tension and also on...
No, I understand that. But okay.
And back pain was the second one.
What I'm wondering about is the pain syndrome that's...
muscle?
That's described in some of these other series.
Well, we didn't sort it quite that. Non-explainable. I thought you said explainable. Pardon me.
Oh, no, I said unexplainable.
Well, I think the others... We didn't see this deep, non-specific pain that M. Belling was talking about. I haven't seen that. Maybe someone else has always filtered those out for me, because most all the patients are referred. The others have been muscle overuse, I would say, and I explained the others on that.
Now,
as far as I can see, I think I can explain them.
Yeah.
And they're either on muscle overuse with chronic strain, or they're ligamentous and skeletal.
Still out of Seattle. How are you handling patients that come to you with the leg length inequalities that they really haven't been wearing lifts for, and they're beginning to, and you're beginning to worry about the back? Have you been able to convert them to lifts to balance them up, or do you insist on it, or how do you handle it?
Well, I haven't learned how to force an adult to do anything. But if they have back pain, I've been able to talk them into it. Usually by figuring out some sort of cosmetic balance of cutting down the heel on one side and adding to the other side. If they don't have pain, they're going to keep doing their thing until they do have pain. And all I can do is tell them...
It's coming.
Tell them what the future is going to be like.
McKinstry, Warm Springs. Would you comment a little bit about scoliosis and polio?
Scoliosis and polio, we have three groups. We have the ones with severe deformities that do not have fusions, and we're treating those in plastic jackets if they're middle-aged and elderly now. And that works very well in the light plastic jacket that just make new one every 2 or 3 years or so, or 5 years. We have a group who are getting pain at the bottom of fusions, and we're treating those also with corsets. Actually, that seemed to work very well. Generally, we've not had to extend the fusion. And the disadvantage of extending fusions in the middle-aged group is you have two problems. One is that middle-aged bone doesn't heal as fast as 17-year-old bone. And secondly, that the paralytic without muscles, we already know we have an increased incidence of non-union even in the 17-year-old, so that we'd prefer not to do surgery unless necessary. Though in the younger ones, we are extending some of the fusions. And then we have the majority of adults with a paralytic scoliosis of about 30 or 40 degrees. I'm not really seeing any pain. I'm just noting it incidental to their leg findings. Now, maybe they're not that vigorous because adult painful scoliosis is certainly a clinical entity in the idiopathic.
Maynard, Ann Arbor. Dr. Perry, did you see many patients with shoulder or upper extremity pains? And
yes, 10% of our patients had upper extremity weakness and increasing loss of strength in their upper extremities. Our approach to that has been to try to change their habits, the way their lifestyle. And
have you had any that had enough weakness that you had to consider some type of an orthosis, or have you done any glenohumeral fusions ever?
We have one woman who's a candidate for shoulder fusion right now, and I have another one who I just saw last week who has weak wrist flexors and marked ulnar deviation.
With what indication then? Yeah.
Pardon?
With what indication for the
shoulder
fusion? Yeah.
She's subluxing markedly and starting and getting pain, and has adequate scapular control that would be worthwhile. The other patient is losing finger flexion strength. I think mostly she's lost some wrist stability, because if you stabilize her wrist, her fingers had good strength. And so we're making her an orthosis to have her identify what a rigid wrist would be like, and then probably we'll go for a fusion and then use the orthosis to protect it after the casting.
Tell me a little bit more about the ankle fusion, the tibio-talar fusion. Do you get later breakdown of the foot? Do you use a rigid sole in the shoe to protect against breakdown in the foot?
Well, if they have a very frail foot, then an arch support, total contact arch support, protects the midfoot. If they have a mobile subtalar joint and are fused at neutral, and I think you have to appreciate that the purpose of the fusion is to prevent excessive dorsiflexion, and that does not mean you should provide excessive plantar flexion as an alternative. Zero is the answer, and this should be done very carefully. Then one has a subtalar joint to essentially be the shock absorber, and you only need about 5 degrees of dorsiflexion in the midfoot, which is all you get anyhow, to get over on the forefoot, and that's not breaking down. And actually, by the time you have the average shoe, you have another 5 degrees from a 3/4-inch heel. And so that is not getting in trouble. The ones who get in trouble are the ones who are put into some degree of plantar flexion to add stability to the knee, which really deprives a person of moving forward, and it's a penalty rather than an assist.
Thanks very much, Dr. Perry. We're out of time.
This session is now concluded.